Today's podcast is brought to you by Newspapers.com, the ultimate destination for exploring the mysteries of the past. If you're fascinated by true crime, get ready to dive into the stories that made headlines. Newspapers.com offers a billion pages of historical newspapers from the U.S. and beyond, and you can search the entire collection in seconds. Their vast newspaper collection is a goldmine for eyewitness accounts, crime scene photos, news reports, and more. Whether you're interested in famous crimes or long-forgotten cases, Newspapers.com gives you a front-row seat to more than 300 years of history. For our listeners, Newspapers.com has a special offer. Use the code CUPOFMURDER for an exclusive 20% discount on your subscription. That's promo code CUPOFMURDER at Newspapers.com. Sign up today and start unraveling the true crime mysteries that keep you up at night. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Do you think you are part of that 75%? I really didn't think that I would be, but when asked to list out all the subscriptions I paid for, one or two slipped through the cracks that I totally forgot about, one of which was for something that I swore I canceled forever ago. Think about it. Between streaming platforms, apps, delivery services, and even parenting/kid subscriptions, though they all seem like small amounts, when pulled together, that's a pretty big chunk of your spending money out the door. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of 500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting time on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/morningcup. That's rocketmoney.com/morningcup. rocketmoney.com/morningcup.
There were two more murders 15 miles away.
When police arrived, they found the telephones and electricity lines.
We have a weird homicide.
A scene described by one investigator as reminiscent of a weird...
Morning. Cup of murder.
Sometimes an investigation receives criticism and makes many wonder if they indeed caught the right suspect. On March 4th, 1941, a man was born who'd become a victim in one such investigation. And because of that, his killer or killers remain free. So if you like your coffee hot but your bones chilled, sit back and start your day with a morning cup of murder. Larry Ralph Payton, born on March 4th, 1941, was just 19 years old when he and his girlfriend, Beverly Ann Allen, made plans to go shopping at the Lloyd Center in Portland, Oregon. The pair had met in the summer of 1960 while both working at the Crater Lake National Park, where Larry's father operated a motor lodge, and after spending the Thanksgiving holiday with her parents, Beverly decided to drive into Portland and spend the weekend with her boyfriend. It was November 26, 1960, and when Larry's Ford coupe was found parked on a remote lover's lane in Forest Park the following evening, one look inside found the Portland State College sophomore's body having suffered from 23 stab wounds and a severe skull fracture. Finding mud covering his clothing, suggesting that he had been outside the vehicle at some point during the attack, the FBI was immediately called to assist in not just the collection of evidence, but the search for Beverly Ann Allen. Though her coat and purse were still in the car, and a pair of broken women's eyeglasses, a necklace, and a broken fingernail were found inside as well, no one seemed to know where the Western Washington University student was, and if she too had met the same fate as her beloved boyfriend. Lying on the hood of the car was a knife, and on the ground was the penknife that Larry carried around with him. A single bullet hole had penetrated the windshield, determined to have been fired from inside the vehicle, and though the gun was not found at the scene, there was blood evidence on both the outside and inside of the coupe. With her father offering an award for anyone that could provide information, the search for Beverly Allen began in full force. Hearing the news, a patron from a restaurant in nearby Eugene reported to investigators that, scrawled across the restaurant's bathroom mirror, was a message in lipstick that read, "I am being held in a brown Ford. Help me." There were also reports that a woman matching Beverly's description was seen at the restaurant, with a male, but the claim was ultimately dismissed by the police when the witness could describe the girl in great detail, but could not recall a single thing about her male companion. The search continued into the new year, but finally on January 9th, 1961, highway workers approximately 30 miles west of Portland called into the police and reported the discovery of a body in a ravine along Sunset Highway. Lying there, face down and nude from the waist up, was the body of Beverly Ann Allen. She was wearing only a pair of dark gray stockings, and lying nearby was one of her shoes, her ski sweater, and a blouse. Her hands were bound together with a green nylon cord, and there was a plastic sheet covered in what appeared to be blood found nearby. Her cause of death, once brought in for an autopsy, was determined to be from strangulation that occurred sometime between 3 a.m. and 7 a.m. on November 27th. There were also signs that the young girl had been sexually assaulted prior to her death. With the investigation switching courses after the discovery, police began questioning the owners of the two abandoned cars found near where Beverly's body was found. One belonged to a Navy sailor stationed in Astoria, and the other to a man from Banks who claimed he had to abandon the vehicle after it got stuck in the mud. Believing the couple might have been abused by at least two men, there was a time when Edward Wayne Edwards, a fugitive with ties to Portland, was considered a suspect, but was eventually cleared. In total, $250,000 were spent on the search and investigation. 2,292 individuals were questioned, 453 suspects were considered, and only 47 of those were definitively cleared of any involvement. With an incredibly lengthy list and not a lot to go off of, the citizens of Portland started to worry as local investigators, prioritizing the case, began combing through the crime scenes, trying to come up with something of use. This, unfortunately, led to complete chaos, with one officer writing in a memo that, quote, "No one department knew what the other had in mind and what was checked." Everything was in shambles, it seemed. So to try and get things back on track, a man named Earl Sun was brought in to take control of the entire investigation. Earl, who solved hundreds of crimes during his career, was considered, quote, "Portland's best investigator." He collected all the evidence he could, and by 1966, he had filled two large metal cabinets in his office just to try and solve the murders of Larry Ralph Payton and Beverly Ann Allen. Though the department still needed him to solve other cases, thus only allowing him to focus on the Lover's Lane murders a little bit at a time, Earl Sun and fellow investigator Jack Elliott, with only a knife, a bullet hole, and a man's sock acting as their key pieces of evidence, were forced to wait until a witness came forward with the necessary piece of information that could finally put this puzzle together. Though it would take 7 years to get their answers, it all seemed to come to a head when Earl, speaking with reporters, told the public that with a murderer like this, the killer likely told someone or gave a hint to their involvement. His assumption turned out to be correct and would lead them straight to not just one killer, but three acting together. In October of 1966, Earl got a letter from a woman who claimed to have information about who killed Larry and Beverly. Identified as Nikki Essex, she divulged information that only someone involved in the murder, or at least told about it in great detail, could possibly know, including the fact that, near the crime scene the night of the murders, there was a house party in Forest Park, and the fact that a knife had been left on the hood of Larry's car. However, there was a problem with the letter writer. Though she clearly knew about what happened that night, she claimed that when she tried to recall the details of the actual attack, her mind drew up a total blank. So they offered, and she agreed, to an injection of sodium amytal and sodium pentothal. That's when she started spilling the real details. According to her claims, a man named Robert Brom and brothers, Eddie and Carl Jorgensen, drag raced Larry Payton and Beverly Allen through the West Hills on the night of the murder. Larry at some point cut them off. And when the three men, with Nikki in tow, caught up with them, they began attacking the teenage couple. Edward Jorgensen, 36 years old, was a married father of five who operated a garage, while his brother, Carl, then 27, was a former boxer and salesman at an upscale shoe store. And both attended that house party in Forest Park the night of the murders. Though their mother denied that her sons could possibly have any involvement in the attacks, on August 13, 1968, a grand jury was held and, in the end, brought forth indictments against Carl, Edward, and their 28-year-old buddy that night, Robert Gordon Braum. A resident of Salem, Robert had previously been imprisoned for beating an elderly grocer with a gun back in 1962 and was actually out on parole the night that Larry and Beverly were killed. Charged with first-degree murder, all three men insisted on their innocence and pleaded not guilty. The Jorgensen brothers were the first to head to trial in November of 1968. And through the testimonies presented in the courtroom, a clearer version of the timeline for that evening started to develop. On the night of November 26, 1960, the brothers and Robert Braum attended the house party held by a Mrs. Stevens. At some point, Edward and Robert went out to purchase more beer and came into contact with Larry and Beverly, who at the time were parked in his Ford. Inviting them to the party, the couple agreed and started following them back. And during the drive, the two cars engaged in a race. Larry forced Robert's car up onto the curb, causing some damage. And furious, Robert drove back to the party, got in a different vehicle, and with Carl and Nikki Essex now along for the ride, they drove back to where they left the couple, found Larry's car, and chased it down a dead-end road in Forest Park. The men all exited the car, Nikki left behind to witness the entire ordeal, and began confronting the couple about the damage. Nikki at some point fled on foot to the main road, and once there, she claimed she heard a, quote, loud crack that sounded like a gunshot. Shortly after the sound, Robert and the Jorgensens returned to the main road in their car and picked up Nikki. Inside with them was Beverly Allen. Robert then dropped Nikki off at her home, and the three men drove off with their young captive. Though her testimony was what led to their identification, Edward Jorgensen's lawyer pointed out to the court that she had undergone hypnosis and injections in order to recall the event that night, and therefore could not be totally trusted. Despite these attempts, Edward Jorgensen was convicted of first-degree murder in the death of Beverly Allen and second-degree murder for the attack on Larry Payton. He was given life in prison with an additional 25 years. As for his brother Carl, when his trial ended in December of 1968, a jury acquitted him of first-degree murder charges, and he was set free. He testified during his brother's trial that, though he was there that night, he was not involved in the actual attacks and the murders. Robert Braum, taken to trial last, was convicted of the first-degree murder of Larry Payton and sentenced to life in prison plus 25 years. In the spring of 1972, Robert and Edward both filed appeals and claimed that Nikki was psychologically unstable and had not undergone a competency evaluation prior to testifying in court against them. Still holding on to the hypnosis and injection claims, the Oregon Supreme Court ultimately denied their review, and that December, Robert was denied a bid for his parole. He filed a second appeal in 1975, claiming his attorney did not adequately represent him. And during the appeal, a private investigator took the stand and testified that a witness told him that Beverly Allen was alive on December 28, 1960, well over a month after the prosecution claimed that she was killed, and that she was seen at a party being held by a local gang and was being prostituted to the partygoers. While these new devastating claims were being made, Edward Jorgensen was released on parole after serving just 3 years in prison. And in January of 1976, both he and Robert filed for relief petitions seeking exoneration. Robert then was paroled after serving 7 years of his sentence. And with that, all three men were walking free. The case and what happened after received incredibly widespread national attention and was credited by some journalists as the, quote, most talked about and written about double murder in the city's history. Because of this massive coverage and the fact that all three men were free and remained steadfast in their innocence, some have come up with theories of their own involving a different course of events the night the couple went missing. In 2010, journalist Phil Stanford stated his belief that Edward and Robert were both paroled so soon because law enforcement didn't even believe in their guilt. He claimed that Nikki, the prosecution's star witness, was given the sodium amytal treatments and hypnosis until she, quote, came up with a story that fit their version of what happened, and that the officers working the case were careless in their investigation, lost the valuable vaginal swabs taken from Beverly's body, and ruined the crime scene that they failed to secure, claiming it was trampled on by reporters, photographers, and other officers, and littered with footprints and cigarette butts. Going further, Phil stated that Edward Wayne Edwards, an early suspect in the case, may have actually been responsible for the murders, as it was a, quote, virtual carbon copy of a double murder he committed in Wisconsin in 1980. He claimed that, when questioned, Edward had a bullet hole in his arm, but when later corresponding with the man, the killer denied any involvement in the Peyton Allen murders and said that he got the bullet injury during a fight with his girlfriend. Some theorize that Edward Wayne Edwards was actually the Zodiac Killer. If this is true, which has never been proven, the young couple was killed years before the Zodiac began his reign of terror. Meaning, if police had arrested and captured him then, if he really was responsible for the Peyton Allen murders and was indeed the famed Zodiac Killer, they may have lost their chance to jail the serial killer before he ever came to California. Thank you for joining me in my morning cup of murder. Please join me again tomorrow to hear a terrible thing happened on March 5th. Don't forget to rate and subscribe and let me know how you like it. If you want to help support the podcast, there's always Patreon or just sharing it with your true crime obsessed friends. And remember, stay safe.